Welcome to the Just Pod, a podcast by the Criminal Justice Section of the ABA, the unified voice of criminal justice. Welcome to this episode of the Just Pod. We are coming back a little earlier than we told you we would come back. It's not February yet, which is when we said we would return for season three. But as you all are aware, January 6th was a historic day in our nation's history, and many of the issues that arose from that day fall into the criminal justice arena. And we felt like it was most appropriate that we come back early to try and provide some insights, explore some issues that arose from that day. So we're going to begin today with an overview of criminal liability of the different events and actions from that day. And so joining us is Joe Whitley. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Emily. Thanks for the invitation.
We feel very fortunate to have you joining us today. Let me share Joe's background. Joe is currently a shareholder with Baker Donaldson and chairs the firm's Government Enforcement and Investigations Group. Joe Whitley was the first general counsel for the United States Department of Homeland Security. Also during the George H. Bush administration, Whitley served as the acting United States Associate Attorney General and has also served as a U.S. attorney in the Northern and Middle Districts of Georgia. Joe also has a long list of roles with the ABA, including being a former chair of the Section of Administrative Law and Regulatory Practice of the American Bar Association. He is a former council member of our section, the Criminal Justice Section, has been vice chair for governmental affairs in 2002 and 2003. For the Criminal Justice Section, chairs a number of seminars and institutes and continuing education programs involving white-collar crime, healthcare fraud, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, internal investigations, and cybercrime. We know him as a chair of the Southeastern White-Collar Crime Institute. And before we jump into our topic for today, we have an announcement to make that involves Joe Whitley. He will be taking on another role for the Criminal Justice Section, and he will be doing that with his fellow chair of the Southeastern White Collar Crime Institute, Brian McAvoy, who has joined us briefly for an exciting announcement. This announcement is that we will be launching a white collar crime focused podcast called Honest Services that'll be led by Joe and Brian. So I'm going to welcome Brian and give you and Joe a chance to introduce this podcast that's coming soon.
Well, thank you, Emily, and thank you for letting me briefly crash today's podcast. We are excited to announce the Honest Services podcast, where we'll be exploring the legal landscape of the white-collar world, featuring leaders from the defense bar, judges, and government attorneys from across the country. And I can't think of a better person to do this with my friend and colleague, Joe Whitley.
Brian, it's great to be in partnership with you. And Emily, I'm so looking forward to this, and we hope it's interactive in the sense that we get lots of input from ABA members and others who listen in. We think it's going to be great to be part of this, and we hope we provide a product that people will really enjoy. Brian, and I can assure you, is a great co-chair, and we're going to do good things with this new program.
Yeah, we are definitely looking forward to the insights that you can bring to the most pressing issues in white-collar crime. And listeners, you can look forward to that. It'll come out under the Just Pod podcast. It's a sister podcast for us, the Honest Services podcast. And so you can still find it in the same place. And it will come out once a month at the end of the month. So the first episode is coming in February. So look out for that. Be excited and watch for it at the end of February for the first episode. So thank you again, Brian, for joining us to help announce this exciting development for our podcast, and we'll look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Thanks, Emily.
Okay, so Joe, we have a lot to cover today. Given your background, if anybody is well suited to try and take on the many different issues and concerns and questions that have come up from January 6th, you seem like as good a fit as we can find. So thank you so much for joining us. Listeners,
thank you, Emily.
Yeah, listeners, what we're going to do is, again, give you an overview, going through the different events and talk about where there's the potential for criminal liability. We're coming back early because we're dedicated to taking on these issues and we're going to do some follow-up episodes. So while we're going to give an overview and make sure that we're being exhaustive in highlighting the different sources of criminal liability, where there's further questions and more conversation to be had, we're planning some follow-up episodes and I plan to make note of that as we progress through our conversation. So let's just begin by recapping the events of that day. And then we're going to talk about where there's the potential for criminal liability. So leading up to January 6th, President Trump had repeatedly told his supporters that the election, the 2020 presidential election, had been stolen by voter fraud, and summoned his supporters to Washington, D.C. to oppose the electoral certification of Congress on January 6th. On January 6th, Trump delivered a speech at his Save America rally on the presidential ellipse at noon. And around 1, Congress began meeting to certify the election results. Meanwhile, protesters headed toward the Capitol building and it turned into a mob. Around the same time, bombs were found at both the RNC and DNC. And by 2:30, crowds broke through the Capitol doors and windows and Congress went into lockdown. Shortly after 4 p.m., the National Guard and state troopers from Virginia and Maryland were sent to the Capitol, and Mayor Bowser of Washington, D.C. set a 6 p.m. curfew. By 6 p.m., the Capitol was secured and Congress resumed the certification of the 2020 election results. So let's start our discussion, Joe, with talking about President Trump and claims of voter fraud. Since January 6th, the House of Representatives voted on a single article of impeachment against President Trump, charging him with incitement of insurrection over the violence at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Trump was impeached for a second time with the charge of inciting violence against the U.S. government. Now, my question for you, Joe, well, I have several, but first, aside from impeachment, which the Senate will vote on, can President Trump face any additional charges for his speeches and tweets that summoned his supporters to DC and called them to action leading up to the violence of January 6th?
Well, this is going to be a question for law review articles, I'm sure. And whether or not there's any charges brought against him is another matter. The sort of the standards for impeachment are very different than criminal prosecutions are. And there's a lot of debate about whether or not the president's speech itself, in other words, certainly the president's speech is protected ordinarily. We all have a right to free speech. And even that rhetoric sometimes can be inflammatory. The Brandenburg versus Ohio case in the Supreme Court in 1969 protects that kind of speech unless it's intended to incite, and quoting, imminent lawless action and as likely to incite or produce such action. So the words the president used, you could argue, were sufficiently vague enough that he did not intend, you could argue this anyway, he did not intend for his supporters to do anything other than peacefully protest outside the Capitol, as he says. However, I understand that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia is looking at whether or not these words were intended to incite a riot. Were those words somehow criminal? Was there a conspiracy among the president's supporters to pursue things that were potentially criminal in nature? So I believe that the words of and in themselves can provide a basis upon which for there to be prosecutions or investigations at the very least of what the president said or did. However, they seem to be sufficiently vague enough, at least in this situation, that one could argue that he was just simply exercising his right of free speech. But did he intend to incite a riot? Well, that really has to be driven by the facts. And I know in the criminal justice section, we have a variety of different views about things, prosecutors in our section, defense attorneys. But I think we all agree upon one thing, which is, what are the facts here? And we really haven't had an exploration of that yet. And I assume if there were to be a trial in the Senate on impeachment, they would explore the facts. But a prosecutor who might bring a case in the situation would really want to see what the president intended by his words, and did the followers clearly understand what he was suggesting? And if that was violence at the Capitol, certainly there could be some investigation at the very least, and then whether or not there's a prosecution is really a matter for the local prosecutor, the U.S. attorney, and the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm. And if I could ask a follow-up question, what is the burden of proof when you're trying to investigate incitement of violence? Like, is it intent? As a communicator, I'm thinking of all the legal liability that comes with statements made from, say, a corporation that you get held accountable to. So what's sort of the equivalent for the role of a president or, you know, someone in leadership? While he's not a corporation, he's the leader of our nation. And so what does that look like?
Well, Emily, all of us, you know, we're held to different standards sometimes. Certainly, we'd like to hold the CEO of a corporation, the president of the United States, to some higher standard. But we have a burden of proof in all criminal cases, felony, if it were to be a felony case, of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that this was a clear and convincing situation where the president uttered words that there could be no debate about it. In other words, a criminal case shouldn't be about a 50-50 proposition. It shouldn't be a preponderance type burden where you have 51% and 49%. It really needs to be something that's near a certainty, not a mathematical certainty, as you say, in some jury charges. So I think that the standard is extremely high. So, you know, was there an encouragement for there to be some insurrection? Was there a seditious conspiracy? These are all things that, you know, was there some attempt to overthrow the government? Did the president participate in that? I think the burden is extremely high. However, obviously, in an impeachment setting, the burden is much lower. And I think that's the difference between the two circumstances that the president is facing in both the impeachment and any sort of criminal investigation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Trump also told his supporters that Mike Pence could send the votes back to the states and that if this was done, Trump would win. Would such an action be legal or constitutional?
I think that every examination of all of this and the constitutional scholars that have looked at it, and Vice President Pence, his lawyers looked at the president's suggestion about the sending of the Electoral College back to the states. All of that was examined thoroughly and it was thought to be unsupportable, that there wasn't a situation where this could be done. I happen to believe that, I mean, from all observations, Vice President Pence is very much a Republican, very much an advocate for the Republican Party views on things, but I think he thought that there was no basis upon which to decline to accept the Electoral College vote. And so that's why he chose to proceed with things. There wasn't a basis upon which to reject the Electoral College in this circumstance.
And is it based on the Constitution, that process of certifying the electoral votes, is it, you know, whether Mike Pence himself had grounds to do it or not, would it even be legal to do that for the certification of electoral votes?
I don't think it was supportable under the Constitution, and it would have been unconstitutional. I happen to think that had this matter been presented to the Supreme Court, had the vice president chose to a path other than that defined by the words of the Constitution, I think it would have been rejected summarily. And I think it would have been a waste of the Supreme Court's time based upon all that I've read and based upon all the analysis that has been done about this, one can be sympathetic with a point of view about the election that, well, was the election fairly conducted? And it seems as though at least all the parties that have looked at the election, including the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, all the courts that presided over some evaluation of the election in terms of fraud or fairness, at least 60 plus court proceedings, all found that there was no basis for the claims that there was fraud in the election sufficient to change the outcome of the election.
Thank you. So, Joe, you were just speaking to the national investigations around voter fraud. And again, we're circling back to this question that's sort of the basis of this whole January 6th turn of events. And just to make sure that we're being thorough, I think that it would be beneficial if we talked about Georgia, for instance, since that was one of the states that drew the most attention, and you happen to be very familiar with how things shook out in Georgia. So if I could just ask more specifically to a specific accused instance of voter fraud, what can you tell us about the voter fraud litigation in Georgia? And was there any evidence validated of voter fraud?
No, there were certainly allegations of voter fraud made by supporters of the president. And those matters did go to the courts here in Georgia. They were looked at thoroughly. Georgia's governor is a Republican and Georgia's Secretary of State is a Republican, both of whom supported President Trump, but both of whom followed their oath of office and were prepared to look at the votes that occurred. And so there were recounting votes that occurred of the votes, and then also further scrutiny of the signatures on ballots and things of that nature to make sure that the absentee ballots and mail-in ballots were fairly cast. And so all of that took place. It was sort of a look and then another look and then a third look at the ballots that were cast in Georgia. And the outcome of the election was extremely close. President-elect Biden won the Georgia election against President Trump by 12,000 votes. Despite that closeness, there wasn't a sufficient change in the outcome from any recount or retabulation of the votes here to change the outcome. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Atlanta and the other two U.S. Attorney's Offices certainly were available and looking at the election to see if there was any unfairness or fraud that occurred during the election. And they found nothing that was sufficient to change the outcome of the election. So this matter also was thoroughly litigated in Georgia's federal and state courts by very capable advocates for the president and by representatives of the state attorney general's office and other law firms defending the outcome. So appropriately, the courts evaluated the election in Georgia, and the outcome was, again, extremely close. I suppose it might be good in elections if the outcome was so overwhelming that there wouldn't be a need for a recount or recasting or checking of the ballots. But in this case, all said, there wasn't any fraud that occurred in Georgia based upon all that was looked at. Again, how the election was conducted in Georgia is another matter. Is there a better way to conduct elections? Is there a technique that might be better? And I think the Georgia legislature will be looking at ways to improve how ballots are cast in Georgia going forward.
Right. You know, other concerns around an election are very different than whether actual fraud happened. And as you said, there was no substantiated evidence of voter fraud. So then my follow-up question to that is there any criminal liability for then declaring voter fraud when it has been litigated and proven an illegitimate claim?
Well, I don't believe there is. And what we're talking about is a subjective appreciation of the voting process. One person's fraud may be another person's sign of integrity. But I think the concerns that have been articulated about this election are really more rooted in how the election was conducted than whether or not there was actual fraud. This is the first election of its kind where we had so many absentee ballots and mail-in ballots happening. So I think when we talk about fraud, we need to be careful and distinguish fraud from the way a process is conducted. In other words, the rules of how the election was going to be handled were set in advance of the election. Those rules were followed, and the allegations of fraud were evaluated by, as I indicated, over 60 different court proceedings. And in all cases, there was no fraud found. And I think we need to move past characterizing it as fraudulent.
Yeah, you make a really good point when you talk about a subjective view. Now, how subjective is voter fraud? Is there a definition? I imagine that there is, and that's why the courts, when we're talking about actual fraud, I imagine that it's not subjective when it comes down to the law, right? And I think that's where you're landing and what you're saying is the bottom line here of whether anybody wants to have a conversation with their state legislation about how voting happens in your state. That's a completely different conversation than determining whether voter fraud has or hasn't happened. And where we're landing and where the courts landed was that voter fraud did not happen.
Absolutely. There was no finding of voter fraud in the United States by any court whatsoever. And court systems in our country are highly diverse. At the federal level, the appointees come from different presidents. Mm-hmm. The state level, different parties serve in those positions. But Republican and Democrat appointees alike came to the same conclusion.
Right. So circling back to liability, if we've defined voter fraud and we've in the courts have come to this conclusion, again, just to recap our conversation or I guess just to bring us to a little bit of a conclusion on this area around Trump. Let's say this was a corporation again, just hypothetically, and I know that corporation standards do not apply. It's not the same. It's not apples and apples with the president of the United States, but conceptually, what sort of liability is there for declaring fraud or a crime when there wasn't one? And, presumably, if the law of the land says this and we've accepted the law of the land as what gives us our final say, then knowing, having that information and then saying that, is there liability there?
It may feed into what's presented to the public by a leader of an organization. In this case, we could talk about the CEO of an organization. There is responsibility. I mean, we'd like to think throughout all of the United States and leadership and organizations to be totally truthful and transparent about things. The politics is such that there isn't, as far as I know, a requirement. If there was a requirement of absolute truth-telling in politics, we might not have many people in public office. I mean, I don't mean that as a criticism. But I think somehow politics is the art of, sometimes accentuating the positive of your point of view and diminishing the opposition's point of view. If we don't find some common ground on the characterization of election outcomes, if they don't go the way we want them to go, they're not necessarily fraudulent. And in this circumstance, it turns out that if there was fraud, it wasn't of sufficient magnitude to change the outcome of the electoral vote counting or of the popular vote in the United States. The consequence of saying these things, I don't believe is so much criminal as it is, I think it erodes the strength of our society, which is we may disagree on many things, but we need to find a way to agree on that our elections have been fair and and if they're not fair, that people will be accountable. The good or bad thing about our country is that I believe it's a good thing, is that speech is protected. So whoever's speaking does not have to speak with absolute total accuracy.
Right. I guess that If we're taking the comparison further, though, if it were a corporation, the CEO speaking on behalf of the corporation, then the corporation would be liable for their comments.
Correct.
From right. a legal standard, have, right?
Right. If you were to say something fraudulent, like our that your stock, some aspect concerning the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC regulations and rules, whatever you say about the value of your stock, if that is inaccurate, and the investing public makes a decision based on that statement in stocks or transactions occur that you might be participating in as the CEO of a corporation, there absolutely is liability for words being spoken in that situation.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to me, you know, something I've observed is that Donald Trump chose to do most of his tweeting from his personal Twitter handle, I mean, which is now banned, but there's a POTUS Twitter handle, and Donald Trump seemed to still use his Twitter handle. So it'll be interesting to me to see if that ends up being any part of the investigation and, you know, how liable he is for those comments. But anyway, that's probably another conversation. Let's move on to another portion of our conversation. Let's move on to the attack on the Capitol. Joe, when does a demonstration of First Amendment rights become an unlawful assembly? And what does unlawful assembly mean in terms of criminal liability for anyone who stays and engages in the assembly at that point?
Well, the First Amendment protects the right to peaceful assembly and protest activities. You know, certainly out of the, I don't know how many thousands of people were at the Ellipse when the president was speaking. That is an example of a peaceful assembly protected by the Constitution. In other words, no matter whether someone is using highly charged language, that language is, you know, in a peaceful setting is protected. So the individuals who were there had every right to assemble and be there in that setting. The transition, though, from that spot at the Ellipse near the White House to the Capitol was when things transitioned from peaceful to really what, by any observation, turned into a riot at the Capitol by some of the individuals there. Other individuals, it seemed, were just sort of caught up in the setting on Capitol Hill. So that's being sorted out right now by law enforcement. The Constitution does not protect armed insurrection, that sort of thing. Coup attempts are not protected by the Constitution. But the First Amendment, you know, is something that we cherish.
And, you know, you did talk about two different groups being there. And, you know, while that could very well be true, as soon as it's declared an unlawful assembly, everybody's got to clear out, though, after that, right? That means you've crossed a line, regardless of what your intentions were, you've crossed a line, and anybody that stays here, you know, now it's unlawful. So now there's criminal liability, right?
Right. There was a point in time when, you know, let's say there were people, outside the Capitol singing songs or whatever that were peaceful. That changed when a number of protesters tried to unlawfully enter the Capitol. Those individuals might be being evaluated for criminal trespass. In other words, I've been to Capitol Hill many times, and it's a beautiful setting there. It's the pantheon of our democracy. And going in and out of this Capitol building has historically been something that I value. However, you can't enter into that building without going through certain processes. And that was being violated in large magnitude by a number of the protesters or rioters. And at that point in time, the protest was no longer peaceful, and law enforcement needed to do at that point to protect the people in the building, to protect themselves, to protect even the people protesting. In other words, any loss of life in that setting is something that we just don't want to accept. And so the law enforcement community at that point in time was doing the best it could to secure the building, which it ultimately did, and also protect the occupants of the building, the legislative operation of government, protect those individuals involved in it.
Yes. To the general public, it appeared that most arrests were made after the attack. You know, whether that's true or not true, we're not necessarily trying to determine that right here in this conversation, but let's talk about this appearance that most arrests were being made after the attack. Do you know why that would be the case? And what impact would that have on an investigation? I know investigations, it's been reported, are continuing, of course, and arrests are still being made, but why would they wait to make arrests?
Well, first and foremost, having been at Homeland Security, our mission there was developing layers of security to protect America. We knew that first and foremost, what we wanted to do was make sure that our whatever we did, we prevented anything from turning into a crime scene. And so I think the Capitol Police and their initial stages of this were trying to push back the crowd, prevent them from entering. And their focus was really not on making arrests because there just weren't enough officers and National Guard troops and others, the Metropolitan Police, available at that time to engage in mass arrest. There just weren't enough law enforcement personnel to do that. So they had a decision, either explicitly or implicitly, was made to protect the building and the occupants in it. I guess first and foremost in their minds was that was what was driving them to protect those two things. And I think that making arrest would have interfered with that because the protecting of the building and the occupants of the building had to be the primary objective, given the limited resources that the law enforcement had at the Capitol building Wednesday, January 6th. So I think that that's the reason you didn't see a lot of arrest. It would have been time consuming and it would have taken people away from the protection role that law enforcement had at the building.
Mm-hmm. So then how can that impact the investigation to then make arrests after the fact?
It does impact it. It makes it much more difficult to gather a case. What you had, though, was a huge amount of humanity in a small space. And so what you do in a situation like that is you do what I said, which is try to prevent harm to the property and harm to individuals. So you have to look retrospectively. You have to gather information voluntarily from people who might have been in the crowd, from obviously body cameras on the Capitol Police that may have been filming some of this. There may be stationary cameras at the Capitol that also were being utilized. And then facial recognition technology is another way of capturing information. There were a number of individuals who chose to expose themselves and make themselves highly prominent, to include an individual who went into Speaker Pelosi's office space and others like that were videoed or filmed, photographed in places that they should not have been in. And then also individuals, you know, in scuffles with law enforcement, some of that might have been filmed by a body camera. So those are a number of ways that law enforcement may be looking kind of retrospectively, trying to identify really two buckets of individuals, the individuals who committed harm to persons or property, perhaps in the category of more felony type crimes, and then trespassers are different in that there probably were hundreds of people who entered into the building and did absolutely nothing. In other words, they just entered into the building unlawfully. They were trespassing at that point. And so the government has to evaluate those two big categories, those two buckets. But I think they'll do that through the use of cooperating witnesses, through the use of cameras and forensic technology. There may be situations in which fingerprints or DNA may be available. So there's a lot there. But again, the volume of people at the Capitol is so extensive that law enforcement's going to have to pick and choose which cases, Emily, they're going to be bringing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we also know that there were bombs found at both the RNC and DNC, in addition to a truck full of explosives and guns. How will these be investigated and potentially charged? Does this go to domestic terrorism? And also, like, what at the Capitol, aside from bombs, too? I'm just curious, is there anything that would be considered domestic terrorism from what we saw at the Capitol?
terrorism is defined in statutory law, and I think there would have to have been some conspiratorial activity by a group of people to, in essence, overthrow the government or for political reasons, try to destroy the building and the occupants in the building. So many of us remember 9/11. We're now talking almost 20 years ago when that happened, but analogizing that to this event, that's probably not a good thing, but you do have individuals who thought that America as an entity should not exist, wanted to destroy individuals in our Capitol buildings and also buildings in New York, who had they lived, most all of them are gone with some exceptions, would have been prosecuted under terrorism laws. The same might apply to some individuals if the government can prove it, if there was some sort of planned activity that occurred at the Capitol that fits within our terrorist laws. More likely, though, I think that the criminal laws will be used in the circumstance against the people who were breaking into the building or harming security personnel at the Capitol. Domestic terrorism is a little harder to define in the sense that we're more focused, at least historically, we've been more focused on external terrorism against the United States. But there are groups on both the right and left in America that probably fit within the definition of domestic terrorist. The bombs at the RNC and DNC are an example of domestic terrorism, in my opinion. The FBI is, I'm sure, investigating those cases, and they've offered a reward of $50,000 for information about who might have placed those bombs at those two headquarters locations for the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. The FBI has photographs of an individual they believe to be responsible for placing those bombs, or at least in one of those locations. They'll be working backward from that, trying to figure out who that individual is. From my observation of the photo, it's hard to tell who the person is, but there may be somebody who knows who that person is by virtue of the clothing that individual has on. So I think that the bomb component of this is really scary. The placement of pipe bombs on Capitol Hill at those two locations certainly raises the stakes a lot in terms of what the FBI is trying to do. An unenviable task of trying to go after those individuals in the sense that it's sometimes a very difficult path, but the FBI is well equipped. Obviously, the individual who exploded the bomb in Nashville, the FBI pretty quickly determined who that individual was. Some years ago, the Murrow building in 1996 that was bombed by a terrorist in Oklahoma City, the FBI was on that investigation quickly and determined who those individuals were that were responsible for that. So, you know, one thing that I know the FBI receives lots of criticism sometimes, but I don't think in terms of its day-to-day duties, its work that it's doing, hard investigative work is going to pay off, and I hope that the individuals responsible for those bombs is apprehended and prosecuted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of interest in what the investigation tools that would be used in something like this. And so we will do a follow-up episode where we explore tools for investigation like facial recognition technology that you mentioned, Joe, and social media. You know, people posting to social media in addition to leads and things like that and corroboration. So listeners, look forward to that. And thank you for your insights there, Joe. I have a few more questions for you, but listeners, before we get into these questions, I just want to clarify, we're very aware that there are a lot of questions around policing that we saw on January 6th, and we're going to do a special episode where we explore that. We're not going to try and cover every concern, every question about that right now. And my questions for Joe, again, this episode is meant to be an overview, so please be mindful of that as I ask my next couple questions. So, Joe, as I said, there are many things to discuss about policing from the day of January 6th, a lot of questions that people want answers to, rightfully so. But there are two natures of investigations that we know are going to happen. So, Joe, if you would help us understand what these investigations would look like. Again, as I mentioned, we will dig into some of the questions around policing of the day another time. For this conversation, what I'd like for you to help us understand is the two natures of investigations that we know are going to be happening. So first, we know that police officers were assaulted. There's videos of police officers being dragged and beaten, police officers being stuck in doors where people are trying to push past them, despite the fact that they're crying out for help and in pain. We know that Brian Sicknick died as a result of his injuries. What would the investigation and potential charges be around those assaults?
Right. In the District of Columbia, you have standard charges that you'd see in any state: murder, attempted murder, assault and battery, other criminal charges, property damage charges associated with all that you saw there in terms of damaging property. The putting together of those charges, the brick by brick that the investigators are going to be doing in terms of building their case, is trying to go back and reconstruct what occurred. And it's like every crime scene, I think it's hard to think of the U.S. Capitol as being a crime scene, right? But what goes on, at a crime scene investigation is the same, whether it's at the Capitol or it's in some city someplace. And that would be trying to determine who the actors were that were involved in the criminal conduct. And that would be looking at the rioters through the lens of the cameras that are posted throughout the Capitol building. The utilization, I know it's highly controversial, facial recognition technology, to see who were the individuals who were harming the Capitol police officers. Who were they? Then trying to identify people who are witnesses in those situations. Our society has turned into heavily social media society. Looking back at the George Floyd situation and any other situation where there is some conduct by individuals, whether they be police or individuals committing a crime, people are filming that. And so there were a lot of cameras being focused on these individual acts. So that would be corroborative of charges that might be brought against the individuals who engaged in property damage or harm to the Capitol police officers. There are, any number of ways to go at this, but I think it's old-fashioned, good old gumshoe police work. And that means approaching individuals who U.S. law enforcement believe have knowledge about this conduct, subpoenas for their social media information, search warrants being executed at some homes of individuals who were involved in this activity, clothing items that the individual might have been wearing when these crimes were occurring, anything to meet the burden of proof if the individual chooses to go to trial that would help them be convicted. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on here, Emily, that I think is just a lot of work. There's a lot to be looked at.
Right. So what is the charge for someone who assaults an officer? And, in the case of Brian Sicknick, we've been told it's going to be investigated as a homicide. What's the charge for just assaulting an officer? Is that what it is? Assault of an officer? Assault.
Yeah, in some states it would be criminal assault, which carries a grievous assault, or attempted murder, manslaughter charges. Intentional manslaughter might be a charge in Georgia. Some states have attempted murder as an alternative charge, involuntary manslaughter. So there are any number, but the attempted murder charge or murder charge, when somebody clearly intends to kill someone, at least based on all the evidence, the prosecutor can choose among those of the many arrows in their quiver to bring these charges. I think they'll be judicious about not overcharging the cases. But at the same time, I don't envy people sifting through this mountain of information and evidence.
Yeah.
But, I can assure you there's a small army of FBI agents looking at this, because what a law enforcement community person wants to see have happen, obviously, you can't prosecute every crime that occurs in the United States. But as to the Capitol, I believe they will be prosecuting many of these individuals for deterrence purposes. This can never happen again. Mm-hmm. And so I would think that law enforcement realizes and appreciates that. So if people understand that they're not going to be slaps on the wrist, but they're going to be serious charges brought, they're less likely to do this ever again. And we can't ever let this happen again. This should be a lesson that we'll never forget.
So one more question for you, Joe, before we wrap up. You know, there are police that are being investigated for their behavior that day. And, you know, we're not asking you to make any sort of determination on their behavior by any means. But do you know anything about what an investigation like that would look like and what potential charges? Let's say hypothetically, presumably, somebody facilitated or just enabled. What would that investigation look like?
Well, most police departments have offices of professional responsibility that look at sort of internal investigations of police conduct. Those are very difficult to do and conduct, but I think there would be some segregation of responsibility. In other words, it's hard to investigate your own agency, but many agencies are, and I'm sure the Capitol Police Department has an office that deals with police conduct or misconduct. And then, of course, there's the FBI that's looking at these situations. More often than not, if there is conduct that doesn't meet the standards of the police department, the remedy in those situations is dismissal of the police officer. It's more of an administrative process.
Yeah. So again, you know, as we talk about these investigations, as I said to you, Joe, and to our listeners, I'll just reiterate, we're certainly in this episode not trying to lay any blame. The point of those questions was just to understand what the potential investigations would be, not to, again, make any sort of assessment about policing that day. There's still a lot of information and context that needs to come forward. And that's going to be our goal to explore that in a later episode. So thank you for helping us better understand what those investigations would look like. Again, our goal for this episode today was to give an overview of where the criminal liability is that there's precedent for. And, you know, Joe, as we were talking, we kind of highlighted what some of the limits are, what some of the ambiguities are of the law. And that's important to know too. Sometimes the general public, when we're trying to make sense of these events and think like, well, that can't be legal, is it? Well, that's our question. And sometimes the answer is, well, there's not a precedent or a law against that. So thank you for all of your insights today. Not an easy conversation. We realize this is not easy for anyone to do, to come in and talk about a day in the history of our nation that will certainly be remembered for a long time and not in a positive way. I know for many of us, it did bring up those feelings that we felt on 9/11, maybe even, you know, I don't want to speak for our audience, for others. I can speak for myself. It was a very difficult day, a painful day, to see this happen to our Capitol and that it happened with just American citizens involved for the most part that we know of. So certainly a challenging conversation and not one where we're trying to, you know, make assessments at this point. We're just trying to provide an overview as you, our listeners, I'm sure, are trying to make sense of that day, trying to know what the right questions are to be seeking answers to. And, you know, as we try and explore what is criminal, what's not criminal from that day, that was what our objective was in this episode. We know that there are more questions. We know that there are more issues that many of you are concerned about. And we're going to do our best to address what we can and try and help you be able to follow along. As you know, obviously, we talked about it on this episode, there are investigations that are continuing. There are investigation tools that will be used in those investigations. We'll be seeing charges brought forward. We may not see some charges brought forward that we would expect to be brought forward. And that's more work to come. And we're going to take that on. So stay tuned and join with us in that. And thank you, Joe, for joining us today. Do you have any final thoughts before we end today? Again, a very difficult task for anyone to come in and try and speak to these things objectively. And we really appreciate you taking that on.
Thank you, Emily. It's been my pleasure and honor to be with you today. I really appreciate the dialogue with you. You fleshed out some issues that we all need to be thinking about. I think about 9/11, and I think about what I call the citizenship that was to all Americans, all 330 million Americans, many of whom may have watched what happened in our Capitol. I think it's, again, another call to citizenship. It's a time to reflect. Our country has had many, many, many significant things happen in the course of our country's history that we're both proud of and ashamed of. And today, January 6, 2021, is a day we'll always remember as a day that we felt some shame about America and what can happen when things get out of control. There is absolutely no excuse whatsoever for what happened at our nation's capital on that day. However, we can learn from it. And I believe the ABA has a significant role in doing that. And it's been a privilege to talk with you about it. Hopefully there are some takeaways that we can learn from this experience. I know some of what I said people will agree with, some people will disagree with it. But I thought it was important for me to join you for this dialogue to talk about it, because we can't hide from talking about it. We need to be open and transparent and be engaged. And if we do have differences of opinion, that's what our country is built on, and trying to find a middle ground and accommodation for other people and being accepting of differences is what our country has been so strong about accomplishing. So we always have to keep that in mind, that we still are really the shining city on the hill, a place where almost all the people in the world would love to be in, if they could be in our country. So it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much again for the invitation, Emily.
Thank you, Joe. And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of the Just Pod.